4. For a while that morning, the thinny warbled so loudly that not even the bullets in their ears would entirely stop up the sound. At its worst, Susanna felt as if the bridge of her nose would simply disintegrate, and when she looked at Jake, she saw he was weeping copiously, not crying the way people do when they're sad, but the way they do when their sinuses are in total revolt. She couldn't get the saw player the kid had mentioned out of her mind. "Sounds Hawaiian," she thought over and over again, as Eddie pushed her grimly along in the new wheelchair, weaving in and out of the stalled vehicles. "Sounds Hawaiian, doesn't it? Sounds fucking Hawaiian, doesn't it, Miss Oh-So-Black-and-Pretty?" On both sides of the turnpike, the thinny lapped all the way up to the embankment, casting its twitching, misshapen reflections of trees and grain elevators, seeming to watch the pilgrims pass as hungry animals in a zoo might watch plump children. Susanna would find herself thinking of the thinny in Eyebolt Canyon, reaching out hungrily through the smoke for Latigo's milling men, pulling them in and some going in on their own, walking like zombies in a horror movie, and then she would find herself thinking of the guy in Central Park again, the wacko with the saw. "Sounds Hawaiian, doesn't it? Counting one thinny, and it sounds Hawaiian, doesn't it?" Just when she thought she could stand it not a moment longer, the thinny began to draw back from I-70 again, and its humming warble at last began to fade. Susanna was eventually able to pull the bullets out of her ears. She tucked them into the side pocket of her chair with a hand that shook slightly.
"That was a bad one," Eddie said.
His voice sounded clogged and weepy. She looked around at him and saw his cheeks were wet, his eyes red.
"Take it easy, Susie boy," he said. "It's my sinuses, that's all. That sound kills them."
"Me too," Susanna said. "My sinuses are okay, but my head aches," Jake said. "Roland, do you have any more aspirin?"
Roland stopped, rummaged, and found the bottle.
"Did you ever see Clay Reynolds again?"
Jake asked, after swallowing the pills with water from the skin he carried.
"No, but I know what happened to him. He got a bunch together, some of them deserters from Farson's army, went to robbing banks. In toward our part of the world, this was, but by then bank thieves and stage robbers didn't have much to fear from gunslingers."
"The gunslingers were busy with Farson," Eddie said.
"Yes. But Reynolds and his men were trapped by a smart sheriff who turned the main street of a town called Oakley into a killing zone. 6 of the 10 in the gang were killed outright. The rest were hung. Reynolds was one of those. This was less than a year later, during the time of Wide Earth." He paused, then said, "One of those shot dead in the killing zone was Coral Thorin. She had become Reynolds's woman, rode and killed with the rest of them." They went on in silence for a bit. In the distance, the thinny warbled its endless song. Jake suddenly ran ahead to a parked camper. A note had been left under the wiper blade on the driver's side. By standing on his toes, he was just able to reach it. He scanned it, frowning.
"What does it say?" Eddie asked.
Jake handed it over. Eddie looked, then passed it to Susanna, who read it in turn and gave it to Roland. He looked, then shook his head. "I can make out only a few words. Old woman, dark man. What does the rest say? Read it to me."
Jake took it back. "The old woman from the dreams is in Nebraska. Her name is Abigail."
He paused.
"Then down here it says, the dark man is in the west, maybe Vegas."
Jake looked up at the gunslinger, the note fluttering in his hand, his face puzzled and uneasy. But Roland was looking toward the palace which shimmered across the highway. The palace that was not in the west, but in the east. The palace that was light, not dark.
"In the west," Roland said.
"Dark man, dark tower, and always in the west."
"Nebraska's west of here, too," Susanna said hesitantly. "I don't know if that matters, this Abigail person, but..."
"I think she's part of another story," Roland said.
"But a story close to this one," Eddie put in. "Next door, maybe. Close enough to swap sugar for salt. Or start arguments."
"I'm sure you're right," Roland said. And we may have business with the old woman and the dark man yet, but today our business is east. Come on. They began walking again. 5.
What about Shimi?
Jake asked after a while. Roland laughed, partly in surprise at the question, partly in pleased remembrance.
He followed us. It couldn't have been easy for him, and it must have been damn scary in places. There were wheels and wheels of wild country between Magus and Gilead, and plenty of wild folks, too. Worse than just folks, mayhap. But Ka was with him, and he showed up in time for year's end fair. He and that damned mule.
Cappy, Jake said.
Appy, Oi repeated, padding along at Jake's heel.
When we went in search of the tower, I and my friends, Shimi was with us as a sort of squire, I suppose you'd say. But Roland trailed off, biting at his lip, and of that he would say no more.
Cordelia?
Susanna asked. The crazy aunt? Dead before the bonfire had burned down to embers. It might have been a heart storm or a brainstorm, what Eddie calls a stroke.
Perhaps it was shame, Susanna said, or horror at what she'd done.
It may have been, Roland said. Waking to the truth when it's too late is a terrible thing. I know that very well.
Something up there,
Jake said, pointing at a long stretch of road from which the cars had been cleared.
Do you see?
Roland did. With his eyes, he seemed to see everything. But it was another 15 minutes or so before Susanna began to pick up the small black specks ahead in the road. She was quite sure she knew what they were, although what she thought was less vision than intuition. 10 minutes after that, she was sure. They were shoes. 6 pairs of shoes, placed neatly in a line across the eastbound lanes of Interstate 70. Chapter 2. Shoes in the Road. 1. They reached the shoes at mid-morning. Beyond them, clearer now, stood the glass palace. It glimmered a delicate green shade, like the reflection of a lily pad in still water. There were shining gates in front of it. Red pennons snapped from its towers in a light breeze. The shoes were also red. Susanna's impression that there were 6 pairs was understandable, but wrong. There were actually 4 pairs and 1 quartet. This latter, 4 dark red booties made of supple leather, was undoubtedly meant for the 4-footed member of their quartet. Roland picked one of them up and felt inside it. He didn't know how many bumblers had worn shoes in the history of the world, but he was willing to guess that none had ever been gifted with a set of silk-lined leather booties.
"Bally, Gucci, eat your heart out," Eddie said. "This is great stuff."
Susanna's were easiest to pick out, and not just because of the feminine sparkly swoops on the sides. They weren't really shoes at all. They had been made to fit over the stumps of her legs, which ended just above the knees.
"Now look at this," she marveled, holding one up so the sun could flash on the rhinestones with which her shoes were decorated, if they were rhinestones. She had a crazy notion that maybe they were diamond chips. "Cappies. After 4 years of getting along with what my friend Cynthia calls circumstances of reduced leg room, I finally got myself a pair of cappies. Think of that."
"Cappies," Eddie mused. "Is that what they call them?"
"That's what they call them, sugar."
Jake's were bright red Oxfords. Except for the color, they would have looked perfectly at home in the well-bred classrooms of the Piper School. He flexed one, then turned it over. The sole was bright and unmarked. There was no manufacturer's stamp, nor had he really expected one. His father had maybe a 12 pairs of fine handmade shoes. Jake knew them when he saw them. Eddie's were low boots with Cuban heels, maybe in this world you'd call them Magus heels, he thought, and pointed toes, what back in his other life had been known as street boppers. Kids from the mid-60s, an era Odetta, Detta, Susanna had just missed, might have called them beetle boots. Roland's, of course, were cowboy boots. Fancy ones you'd go dancing rather than droving in such as these, looped stitching, side decorations, narrow, haughty arches. He examined them without picking them up, then looked at his fellow travelers and frowned. They were looking at each other. You would have said three people couldn't do that, only a pair. But you only would have said it if you'd never been part of a quartet. Roland still shared Kef with them. He felt the powerful current of their mingled thought, but could not understand it. Because it's of their world. They come from different wends of that world, but they see something here that's common to all three of them. "What is it?" he asked. "What do they mean, these shoes?"
"I don't think any of us know that exactly," Susanna said.
"No," Jake said. "It's another riddle." He looked at the weird, blood-red Oxford shoe in his hands with distaste. "Another goddamned riddle." "Tell what you know." He looked toward the glass palace again. It was perhaps 15 New York miles away now, shining in the clear day, delicate as a mirage, but real as, well, as real as shoes. "Please tell me what you know about these shoes."
"I got shoes, you got shoes, all God's children got shoes,"
Odetta said.
"That's the prevailing opinion, anyway."
"Well," Eddie said, "we got 'em anyway. And you're thinking what I'm thinking, aren't you?"
"I guess I am.
You, Jake?" Instead of answering with words, Jake picked up the other Oxford. Roland had no doubt that all the shoes, including Oi's, would fit perfectly, and clapped them briskly together three times. It meant nothing to Roland, but both Eddie and Susanna reacted violently, looking around, looking especially at the sky, as if expecting a storm born out of this bright autumn sunshine. They ended up looking at the glass palace again, and then at each other in that knowing, round-eyed way that made Roland feel like shaking them both until their teeth rattled. Yet he waited. Sometimes that was all a man could do. "After you killed Jonas, you looked into the ball," Eddie said, turning to him.
"Yes."
"Traveled in the ball."
"Yes, but I don't want to talk about that again now. It has nothing to do with these..."
"I think it does," Eddie said. "You flew inside a pink storm, inside a pink gale, you could say. Gale is a word you might use for a storm, isn't it? Especially if you were making up a riddle."
"Sure," Jake said.
He sounded dreamy, almost like a boy who talks in his sleep.
"When does Dorothy fly over the wizard's rainbow? When she's a gale."
"We ain't in Kansas anymore, sugar," Susanna said, and then voiced a strange, humorless bark, which Roland supposed was a species of laughter. "May look a little like it, but Kansas was never, you know, this thin."
"I don't understand you," Roland said. But he felt cold, and his heart was beating too fast. There were thinnies everywhere now, hadn't he told them that? Worlds melting into one another as the forces of the tower weakened, as the day when the rose would be plowed under drew nearer.
"You saw things as you flew," Eddie said. "Before you got to the dark land, the one you called Thunderclap, you saw things. The piano player Sheb, who turned up again later in your life, didn't he?"
"Yes, in Tull.
And the dweller with the red hair?
Him too. He had a bird named Zoltan. But when we met, he and I, we said the normal life for you, life for your crop, that sort of thing. I thought I heard the same when he flew by me in the pink storm, but he really said something else."
He glanced at Susanna. "I saw your wheelchair, too, the old one."
"And you saw it a witch."
"Yes. I, in a creaky chortle that reminded Roland unnervingly of Rhea, Jake Chambers cried,
"I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too."
Roland stared at him, trying not to gape.
"Only in the movie, the witch wasn't riding a broom," Jake said. "She was on her bike, the one with the basket on the back."
"Yeah. No reap charms either," Eddie said. "Would have been a nice touch, though. I tell you, Jake, when I was a kid, I used to have nightmares about the way she laughed."
"It was the monkeys that gave me the creeps," Susanna said. "The flying monkeys. I'd get thinking about 'em, and then have to crawl into bed with my mom and dad. They'd still be arguing about whose bright idea was to take me to that show in the first place when I fell asleep between 'em."
"I wasn't worried about clapping the heels together," Jake said. "Not a bit. It was Susanna and Eddie he was speaking to. For the time being, it was as if Roland wasn't even there. I wasn't wearing them, after all.
True, Susanna said, sounding severe, but you know what my daddy always used to say.
No, but I have a feeling we're going to find out, Eddie said.
She gave Eddie a brief, severe look, then turned her attention back to Jake.
Never whistle for the wind unless you want it to blow, she said.
And it's good advice, no matter what young Mr. Foolish here may think.
Spanked again, Eddie said, grinning.
Spanked, Oi said, eyeing Eddie severely.
Explain this to me, Roland said in his softest voice. I would hear. I would share your kef. And I would share it now.
2. They told him a story almost every American child of the 20th century knew, about a Kansas farm girl named Dorothy Gale who had been carried away by a cyclone and deposited along with her dog in the land of Oz. There was no I-70 in Oz, but there was a yellow brick road which served much the same purpose, and there were witches, both good and bad. There was a quartet comprised of Dorothy, Toto, and 3 friends she met along the way, the Cowardly Lion, the Tin Woodman, and the Scarecrow. They each had bird and bear and hare and fish a fondest wish, and it was with Dorothy's that Roland's new friends, and Roland himself for that matter, identified the most strongly. She wanted to find her way home again. The Munchkins told her that she had to follow the yellow brick road to Oz, Jake said, and so she went. She met the others along the way, sort of like you met us, Roland.
Although you don't look much like Judy Garland, Eddie put in.
And eventually they got there. To Oz, the Emerald Palace, and the guy who lived in the Emerald Palace. He looked toward the glass palace ahead of them, greener and greener in the strengthening light. And then back to Roland.
Yes, I understand. And was this fellow Oz a powerful din? A baron, perhaps a king?
Again the 3 of them exchanged a glance from which Roland was excluded.
That's complicated, Jake said. He was sort of a humbug.
A bumhug? What's that?
Humbug, Jake said, laughing. A faker. All talk, no action. But maybe the important thing is that the wizard actually came from
wizard, Roland asked sharply. He grasped Jake's shoulder with his diminished right hand. Why do you call him so?
Because that was his title, Shug, Susanna said. The Wizard of Oz.
She lifted Roland's hand gently but firmly from Jake's shoulder.
Let him tell it now. He don't need you to squeeze it out of him.
Did I hurt you, Jake? I cry your pardon.
No, I'm fine, Jake said. Don't worry about it.
Anyway, Dorothy and her friends had a lot of adventures before finding out the wizard was a bumhug. Jake giggled at this, with his hands clapped to his forehead and pushing back his hair like a child of 5. He couldn't give the lion courage, the scarecrow a brain, or the Tin Woodman a heart. Worst of all, he couldn't send Dorothy back to Kansas. The wizard had a balloon, but he went without her. I don't think he meant to, but he did.
It seems to me, from your telling of the tale, Roland said, speaking very slowly, that Dorothy's friends had the things they wanted all along.
That's the moral of the story, Eddie said. Maybe that's what makes it a great story. But Dorothy was stuck in Oz, you see. Then Glinda showed up, Glinda the Good. And as a present for smooshing one of the bad witches under her house and melting another one, Glinda told Dorothy how to use the ruby slippers, the ones Glinda gave her.
Eddie raised the red Cuban-heeled street boppers which had been left for him on the dotted white line of I-70. Glinda told Dorothy to click the heels of the ruby slippers together 3 times. That would take her back to Kansas, she said. And it did.
And that's the end of the tale?
Well, Jake said, it was so popular that the guy who wrote it went ahead and wrote about 1,000 more Oz stories.
Yeah, Eddie said, everything but Glinda's Guide to Firm Thighs.
And there was this crazy remake called The Wiz, starring black people.
Really? Susanna asked. She looked bemused.
What a peculiar concept. But the only one that really matters is the first one, I think, Jake finished.
Roland hunkered and put his hands into the boots which had been left for him. He lifted them, looked at them, put them down again. Are we supposed to put them on, do you think? Here and now? His three friends from New York looked at each other doubtfully. At last Susanna spoke for them, fed him the kef which he could feel but not quite share on his own.
Best not to right now, maybe. Too many badass spirits here.
The Koro spirits,
Eddie murmured, mostly to himself. Then,
look, let's just take them along. If we're supposed to put them on, I think we'll know when the time comes. In the meantime, I think we ought to beware of bumhogs bearing gifts.
It cracked Jake up, as Eddie had known it would. Sometimes a word or an image got into your funny bone like a virus and just lived there a while. Tomorrow, the word bumhug might mean nothing to the kid. For the rest of today, however, he was going to laugh every time he heard it. Eddie intended to use it a lot, especially when old Jake wasn't expecting it. They picked up the red shoes which had been left for them in the eastbound lanes, Jake took Oi's, and moved on again toward the shimmering glass castle.
Oz, Roland thought. He searched his memory, but he didn't think it was a name he had ever heard before, or a word of the high speech that had come in disguise, as Char had come disguised as Charlie. Yet it had a sound that belonged in this business, a sound more of his world than of Jake's, Susanna's, and Eddie's, from whence the tale had come.
3. Jake kept expecting the Green Palace to begin looking normal as they drew closer to it. The way the attractions in Disney World began to look normal as you drew close to them. Not ordinary, necessarily, but normal. Things which were as much a part of the world as the corner bus stop, or mailbox, or park bench. Stuff you could touch. Stuff you could write Fuck Piper on if you took a notion. But that didn't happen. Wasn't going to happen. And as they neared the Green Palace, Jake realized something else. It was the most beautiful, radiant thing he had ever seen in his life. Not trusting it, and he did not, didn't change the fact. It was like a drawing in a fairy tale book, one so good it had become real somehow. And, like the thinny, it hummed, except that this sound was far fainter and not unpleasant. Pale green walls rose to battlements that jutted and towers that soared, seeming almost to touch the clouds floating over the Kansas plains. These towers were topped with needles of a darker emerald green. It was from these that the red pennants flickered. Upon each pennant, the symbol of the open eye had been traced in yellow.
It's the mark of the Crimson King, Jake thought. It's really his Sigul, not John Farson's.
He didn't know how he knew this, how could he, when Alabama's Crimson Tide was the only crimson anything he knew, but he did.
So beautiful, Susanna murmured.
And when Jake glanced at her, he thought she was almost crying.
But not nice, somehow. Not right. Maybe not downright bad, the way the thinny is, but
not nice. Eddie said, yeah, that works. Not a red light, maybe, but a bright yellow one just the same.
He rubbed the side of his face, a gesture he had picked up from Roland without even realizing it, and looked puzzled.
It feels almost not serious. A practical joke.
I doubt it's a joke, Roland said. Do you think it's a copy of the place where Dorothy and her quartet met the false wizard?
Again, the three erstwhile New Yorkers seemed to exchange a single glance of consultation. When it was over, Eddie spoke for all of them.
Yeah, probably. It's not the same as the one in the movie, but if this thing came out of our minds, it wouldn't be. Because we see the one from L. Frank Baum's book, too, both from the illustrations in the book and the ones from our imaginations, Jake said.
But that's it, Susanna said. I'd say we're definitely off to see the wizard.
You bet, Eddie said.
Because
of the wonderful things he does, Jake and Susanna finished in unison, then laughed, delighted with each other, while Roland frowned at them, feeling puzzled and looking left out.
But I have to tell you guys, Eddie said, that it's only going to take about one more wonderful thing to send me around to the dark side of the Psycho Moon, most likely for good.
4. As they drew closer, they could see Interstate 70 stretching away into the pale green depths of the castle's slightly rounded outer wall. It floated there, like an optical illusion.
Closer yet, and they could hear the pennants snapping in the breeze and see their own ripply reflections, like drowned folk who somehow walk at the bottoms of watery tropical graves. There was an inner redoubt of dark blue glass. It was a color Jake associated with the bottle's fountain pen ink came in, and a rust-hued wall walk between the redoubt and the outer wall. That color made Susanna think of the bottle's Heyer's root beer had come in when she was a little girl. The way in was blocked by a barred gate that was both huge and ethereal. It looked like wrought iron which had been turned to glass. Each cunningly made stake was a different color, and these colors seemed to come from the inside, as if the bars were filled with some bright gas or liquid. The travelers stopped before it. There was no sign of the turnpike beyond it. Instead of roadway, there was a courtyard of silver glass, a huge flat mirror, in fact. Clouds floated serenely through its depths. So did the image of the occasional swooping bird. Sun reflected off this glass courtyard and ran across the green castle walls in ripples. On the far side, the wall of the palace's inner ward rose in a glimmery green cliff, broken by narrow loophole windows of jet-black glass. There was also an arched entry in this wall that made Jake think of St. Patrick's Cathedral. To the left of the main doorway was a sentry box made of cream-colored glass shot through with hazy orange threads. Its door, painted with red stripes, stood open. The phone booth-sized room inside was empty, although there was something on the floor which looked to Jake like a newspaper. Above the entry, flanking its darkness, were two crouching, leering gargoyles of darkest violet glass. Their pointed tongues poked out like bruises. The pennants atop the towers flapped like schoolyard flags. Crows cawed over empty cornfields now a week past the reap. Distant, the thinny whined and warbled.
"Look at the bars of this gate," Susanna said. She sounded breathless and awestruck. "Look very closely."
Jake bent toward the yellow bar until his nose nearly touched it, and a faint yellow stripe ran down the middle of his face. At first he saw nothing, and then he gasped. What he had taken for motes of some kind were creatures, living creatures imprisoned inside the bar, swimming in tiny schools. They looked like fish in an aquarium, but they also, their heads, Jake told himself, I think it's mostly their heads, looked oddly, disquietingly human. As if, Jake thought, he were looking into a vertical golden sea, all the ocean in a glass rod, and living myths no bigger than grains of dust swimming within it. A tiny woman with a fish's tail and long blonde hair streaming out behind her swam to her side of the glass, seemed to peer out at the giant boy. Her eyes were round, startled, and beautiful, and then flipped away again. Jake felt suddenly dizzy and weak. He closed his eyes until the feeling of vertigo went away, then opened them again and looked around at the others.
"Cripes, are they all the same?"
"All different, I think," said Eddie, who had already peered into two or three. He bent close to the purple rod, and his cheeks lit up as if in the glow of an old-fashioned fluoroscope. "These guys here look like birds, little tiny birds." Jake looked and saw that Eddie was right. Inside the gate's purple upright were flocks of birds no bigger than summer minges. They swooped giddily about in their eternal twilight, weaving over and under one another, their wings leaving tiny silver trails of bubbles.
"Are they really there?" Jake asked breathlessly. "Are they, Roland, or are we only imagining them?"
"I don't know. But I know what this gate has been made to look like."
"So do I," Eddie said.
He surveyed the shining posts, each with its own column of imprisoned light and life. Each of the gate's wings consisted of six colored bars. The one in the center, broad and flat instead of round, and made to split in two when the gate was opened, was the 13th. This one was dead black, and in this one nothing moved.
"Oh, maybe not that you can see, but there are things moving around in there, all right," Jake thought. "There's life in there, terrible life, and maybe there are roses, too, drowned ones."
"It's a wizard's gate,"
Eddie said. Each ball has been made to look like one of the balls in Maryland's rainbow. Look, here's the pink one. Jake leaned toward it, hands propped on his thighs. He knew what would be inside even before he saw them. Horses, of courses. Tiny herds of them, galloping through that strange pink stuff that was neither light nor liquid. Horses running in search of a drop they would never find, mayhap. Eddie stretched his hands out to grasp the sides of the central post, the black one.
Don't! Susanna called sharply.
Eddie ignored her. But Jake saw his chest stop for a moment and his lips tighten as he wrapped his hands around the black bar and waited for something. Some force perhaps sent special delivery all the way from the Dark Tower itself to change him or even to strike him dead. When nothing happened, he breathed deep again and risked a smile. No electricity, but... He pulled. The gate held fast. No give, either. I see where it splits down the middle, but I get nothing. Want to take a shot, Roland? Roland reached for the gate, but Jake put a hand on his arm and stopped him before the gunslinger could do more than give it a preliminary shake.
Don't bother. That's not the way.
Then what is? Instead of answering, Jake sat down in front of the gate near the place where this strange version of I-70 ended and began putting on the shoes which had been left for him. Eddie watched a moment, then sat down beside him.
I guess we ought to try it, he said to Jake, even though it'll probably turn out to be just another bum hug.
Jake laughed, shook his head, and began to tighten the laces of the blood-red Oxfords. He and Eddie both knew it was no bum hug. Not this time. 5.
Okay, Jake said when they had all put on their red shoes. He thought they looked extraordinarily stupid, especially Eddie's pair. I'll count to 3, and we'll click our heels together, like this.
He clicked the Oxfords together once, sharply, and the gate shivered like a loosely fastened shutter blown by a strong wind. Susanna cried out. There followed a low, sweet chiming sound from the Green Palace, as if the walls themselves had vibrated.
I guess this'll do the trick, all right, Eddie said. I warn you, though, I'm not singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. That's not in my contract.
The rainbow is here, the gunslinger said softly, stretching his diminished hand out to the gate. It wiped the smile off Eddie's face.
Yeah, I know. I'm a little scared, Roland.
So am I. The gunslinger said, and indeed Jake thought he looked pale and ill.
Go on, sugar, Susanna said. Count before we all lose our nerve. 1, 2, 3.